So, Michael, you were talking about, I think, Nicholas Sampson, I think.
Yes, Nicholas Sampson, who was, of course, the figurehead for the coup which deposed Makarios. And I'll tell you a little story about that, because it is quite colourful, and I think it can now be told. Nicholas Sampson, who was a murderer, a terrorist, a thug, how could any nation have a guy like that and pretend that this was a, you know, something that could be swept under the carpet? This man was, not only did he eliminate quite a lot of Greek Cypriots because they weren't of his persuasion, and that has been forgotten, swept under the carpet, but he was systematically eliminating the Turkish Cypriots. And if the Turkish nation hadn't invaded, and we were so bloody wet about it, we were just wringing our hands and reinforcing the SBA, and the Americans were wringing their hands because they hadn't been able to stop the Turks, there wouldn't be a single Turkish Cypriot left alive on that island. So to turn around later and then to put sanctions on the Turks, I think was an outrage, and still is. And I think it was, all I can say is that the Greek propaganda, and particularly the Greek lobby in America, has a lot to answer for the truth, which was quite the reverse. The Turks had no alternative, and their behaviour during the invasion, I can assure you, because I know from people who lived in the village, I have a little house in northern Cyprus which I'd bought in 1969, and you know, my village was entirely Greek, and we had Greek friends. The village was completely riven between the Greek pro-Grives and the pro-Makarios, and there is very strong evidence that they were fighting each other, because our house was shot up, and you know, there was blood around the place, and that was, we know, before the Turks ever got there. So this was a period which I think brought home to me, you know, the real problems, the real reason why 1974 took place.
Before we leave Cyprus and your period there, you mentioned earlier the development of something called evasion. And you've mentioned several times so far in our talk this afternoon new developments that were coming forward, one of which was a, a reinvention of something old like dispersal. But when a new tactic like evasion is comes forward or is developed, who does that? Is it some boffin who sits back in the UK who devises this, or is it really the people on the ground, or rather in the air, who devise it themselves, and then
I think they're
yes.
In this particular case, we devised it ourselves because it was a tactic. But very often, new techniques emerge from new equipment. For example, whilst I was there, we got the Red Top missile, which gave you a head-on capability. Before that, all air-to-air missiles had to be fired from the rear in the heat, you know, from the exhaust plume. But an aircraft that's going fast actually generates heat on its wings. And if you've got a sufficiently sensitive head on a missile, you can fire it head on. This meant charging towards the target. The target was assumed to be doing around about Mark 1 or Mark 1.2. And you would be doing Mark 1.5 or 1.6, so you had a combined speed of nearly Mark 3. That was going some, I can tell you. And you would pick up this target, lock on, pull up, because they usually were going pretty high. So was the belief that this would be. They had the Russians had an aircraft called the Blinder in NATO jargon, which was capable of doing that sort of speed. And you'd fire your missile off, roll on your back, and sort of pull away from it. And your closing speed, and we're talking about seconds to collision. But you know, that was a new piece of equipment that gave us an opportunity to introduce a new tactic. So sometimes they go hand in hand. Sometimes bright guys on squadrons and conversion units indeed come up with a new idea.
And what countermeasures did the Blinder and other Russian aircraft have? To what extent did you know of them, and how did you try to counter the countermeasures?
A very good question. The Russians always have been, still are, very adept in electronic warfare. And I think one of our great concerns was that they believed basically in pumping out lots of electronics and just swamping the radars. And we had on our aeroplanes, and the ground radars had, a number of counters to that, which we would deploy, and some of which were pretty secret. But our concern was that despite that, the Russians, if they did come, would have such an overwhelming level of electronic warfare that we'd find it very, very difficult. For that, we had to develop tactics where we couldn't see the target. All we could do was home on jam, as it's called, home on the noise that would be generated in your radar screen. And we did. And, you know, we tested that through this evaluation process, and it was reasonably effective. But it was a concern, and, the concern of electronic warfare exists today. Somebody with a really strong capability electronically can cause havoc in defensive and offensive systems. It can turn them to jelly.
Well, we've seen that in Iraq.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
However, Iraq's another matter. You now leave Cyprus in 1969.
69.
69. And can you tell me?
Yes, I go to headquarters 11 Group, what had been fighter command as what was called Ops Overseas, which was a marvellous job, actually, which required me to go around all the bases to which we would be sending our airplanes, our fighter airplanes, and set up exercises and set up things. So I did a lot of travelling in Europe in particular, and Far East, Middle East, and back to Cyprus, of course. And unfortunately, I only did that for about 8 months, because I was whizzed off to Staff College, to Bracknell, to the Royal Air Force Staff College at Bracknell, where I had a year there, which was an interesting period because, like all the staff colleges, we had a large number of overseas students on it. Although it was quite new for Bracknell. Previously, they'd had another staff college called Andover, where the foreign students and some RAF went, and then Bracknell was purely for RAF. They then amalgamated them. So we got all these overseas students, and I think the course was about 90 strong, of which 40 or so would have been overseas students. That was good fun, very good fun.
And this, of course, is really compulsory if you want to achieve any...
Yes, it's one of the things. I took the examination for it some years before and passed that when I was at Cultural Link. And
this is the entrance exam to start.
Yes, yes, thing called the Q. I don't know why it was called the Q, but anyway, it was. And if you didn't pass that examination, you didn't go. So, you know, some really good people who, in normal course of events, you thought would have gone through, and perhaps did find sometimes a way through the system. But I think if you really wanted the ticks in the box, you had to go to Staff College, and you had to do reasonably well there.
Yes. And you were there at Staff College for how long?
1 year.
Right.
Yeah.
And the overseas students would have been Commonwealth, mainly?
No, all over the world. Obviously, a good number of Commonwealth.
Except the
we didn't have the Soviet Union. We didn't have any Chinese, but we certainly had. We had Iranians up the gazoo, lots of Iranians, who, of course, wasn't much later that the poor old Shah was deposed. We had. Did we have an Israeli? No, we didn't have an Israeli, but we certainly had Lebanese. We had Kuwaiti. We had perhaps the old South American. We had some Africans. Americans.
Black Africans,
yes, yeah. Yes, yes. They were old Commonwealth, of course.
Yes.
Yes. Perhaps even new Commonwealth, I think back. But so it was, you know, Indian, Pakistani, Ceylonese.
Some of these people, of course, would have been flying, would have in their own
time
period.
Yes.
Their careers, of course, have been flying what one could describe as jets that would have been your opponent.
That's a very interesting point. And certainly the Indians had...
some Russians.
Had some Russian airplanes.
Russian jets.
That's right, yes. So that was very interesting.
It seems to be an enormous, in one sense. Of course, the breach of security, if I can put it that way, will work both ways, because the Indians can go back to India and be quietly debriefed by Russian people.
Yes, I think I think the system was pretty adept at ensuring that, you know, not, I mean, I think one of the strengths of our organisation has always been that we are quite prepared to talk about things, certainly to a degree anyway, airman to airman, and not, I mean, the classification of things is usually, they're vastly overclassified. Confidential is, you know, stuff you'd tell your grandmother. Secret is stuff that you can probably read in the newspapers. Top secret is probably getting a bit serious. The rest of it, vastly overclassified most of the time. So, you know, to give them confidential information made them feel, golly, wow, we're really getting something. Whereas, as I say, you could read that in most newspapers, if not.
Or James.
James, exactly.
Yeah. So no difficulties there, but presumably you would have had a lot of fun exchanging, one assumes, tactical and performance information between what you were doing and
yes.
what they might do with the
I think much of that was done informally. The course itself was pretty formal. And although people had the opportunity to perhaps bring a measure of their previous experience to bear on a particular exercise, most of the exercises, it was about turning you into a staff officer. And so the rules are fairly rigid, you know. Military writing is imaginative. It's it's following the rules. I mean, it's very logical. It's a very good mind training. And in fact, I'd venture to say that the process by which staff papers are written, provided it doesn't become sort of, you know, all-consuming, is one that many people would benefit from. You can see some, you know, and particularly academia, dare I say it. You know, it's a very logical process, but necessarily it has to be disciplined, because you can't be getting imaginative papers on, you know, things to generals in a wartime situation. He wants to look for, you know, the situation and recommendations and things like that, and he wants them cold, crisp, clear, concise, correct, they used to tell us.
And preferably ones at work too.
Well, yeah, that always helps.
You just mentioned turning you into a staff officer. That, to me, opens one or two questions, one of which is staff officers, in my inexperienced mind, means you keep your feet on the ground, so
yeah.
no more flying.
Yeah.
And would it be that no one really goes to staff college now then, unless you really wanted to be a serious professional officer, full-time officer, which means you would go as far as you could? Would those two assumptions be?
Well, the answer is yes and no. Anybody who goes to staff college would have been on a commission that would have taken them up to the year of 38. So that was a permanent commission, about as permanent as you got to then, to 38. And the average age of our staff college year was about 31, I think. Might have been 33, something like that. The proposition being that although, yes, you would go on the ground as a staff officer, that year as a squadron leader on the staff would then fit you for promotion to wing commander rank, because what you needed to get to wing commander was a good operational tour. I'd had a good operational tour, and then a staff tour of reasonable success. Then, you know, they could say, right, balanced chap, promote him to wing commander, go back flying again.
Back flying again.
Yeah. So that was really the progression. And most of us who went through, all of us went through there, had every expectation of going back flying as a wing commander at some stage.
And you still had 5 or 6, even 7 years, possibly at 31, average.
Yes.
Before your permanent commission was up, if I can
yes.
call it that way.
Yes.
So would it be the case that the choice as to whether to be a, to make it completely your career,
yeah.
Was just looming over there somewhere.
It was looming over there. I mean, what you had to acknowledge was that if you attended Scarf College, there had to be a return on that investment, and I think that was a 5-year one, something like that. So, in other words, they wouldn't let you leave the service until you've done a certain number, 3 to 5, can't remember, years after Staff College. You had agreed to that. But in my case, that was fine. It was, you know, it was about right.
Now, before we finish this afternoon, you leave Staff College then probably end of 71?
End of 1970.
End of 70?
Yes.
Sorry. end of 70, and where did you go?
I was sent as what's called a personal staff officer to the Deputy Commander-in-Chief, Allied Forces Central Europe. Four-star airman called Chief Marshal Sir Frederick Rosier. The command structure there was a German four-star cinq-cent Commander-in-Chief Central Region, Allied Forces Central Europe, I think. Allied Forces, yes, AFCENT. And then a deputy, the senior airman, in the Central Region of NATO, who was Sir Frederick Rosier. And then a Chief of Staff, who was a Belgian, I think. Anyway, that was the command structure, the two sort of most powerful men there. And I went to be the personal staff officer to this airman. And I did nearly 3 years out there, so 2.5. And I saw Sir Fred out, and then Air Chief Marshal Sir Lewis Hodges. I did about 3 months with him. He took over from him. And it was an international and joint service environment. And very, very instructive. Learned a lot, huge amount. A lot about NATO, a lot about working with the other nations, of course, and with all the services. In our office, there was a colonel, army colonel, so that was good. And then, you know, right next door was the Cinque Sense office, which had lots of Germans all over the place, and there was an American general just across the way, and then there's a Belgian general. We were called the command group. I was very privileged, you know, on the coattails to watch all this going on. And my job was to sort of... I used to do the writing and informing for Sir Fred, play tennis with him, keep an eye on the general sort of management of the whole system, and brief, particularly on the operational side, because one of the things he had to do... I talked about tactical evaluations earlier. All of them found their way to his office, ultimately, for him to have a look at. And so, you know, I was quite experienced, I suppose, or quite useful to him in having looked through these and saying, yes, but, you know, you might think of that.
Now, at another time, if we may, we'll go into this in a little more detail, but I'll conclude this afternoon. This seems, just by saying this, really, or comment if you may, if you would, this seems to have been as testing or more testing than flying Lightnings at 200 feet in the dark.
Different test. I suppose one either has or learns the skills of diplomacy, because that's really what it was, working with other nations in an environment, albeit an environment in which you had common goals, mostly common goals. You do have to learn the skills of diplomacy, because every nation is very sensitive. I remember the sensitivities, you know. One of our biggest problems was there that there was an inner caucus of intelligence which was Canadian, American, British. And we had our own intelligence, and it was infinitely better than the commander-in-chief, who was a German four-star, was able to get, because they went in on it, because we didn't trust them. Not that we didn't trust him, but we didn't trust the German system, which was leaky as hell, because these Germans had penetrated it. So we had our own briefings, and we had to, you know, pretend that the special shop that we had was just somewhere where we went for coffee or something. And it was bloody obvious, and everybody in headquarters knew, but we were getting the briefings, Rear McCoy from London and from Washington, where the rest of them were floundering on with some pretty Mickey Mouse stuff. You know, one learned how to handle that. One learned how to handle German dogmatism, appreciate their industry, appreciate above all that they were working in a foreign language and doing bloody well in it, remarkably so. Appreciate, you know, they brought a huge amount to bear, and Beneker, who was the commander-in-chief, had fought in World War II, very distinguished, I think he was a paratrooper, big man, but, you know, worth listening to, really worth listening to, these guys. Appreciate the differences between the Americans and ourselves, something that's stood me in very good stead. I mean, I love Americans dearly. They're the most generous, marvellous people, but anybody who thinks that they think the same as we do is in for a big disappointment. You learn that in that sort of environment. Learn to love the Canadians. Saddened by what happened to them. It started there. Started, you know, they made them all wear the same colour uniform, part of the political correctness that I think was Trudeau and all of that lot. And to watch what's happened to the Canadian Armed Forces, who at that time were the icon, the model for peacekeeping around the world, who've descended now into almost an irrelevance. Tragic. Tragic. The politicians, it's disgraceful what they did to the Canadian Armed Forces over many years. You learn all of that. And then we had the French, because of course we'd all been in Fontainebleau and places like that before. The French had kicked us out. So they had a military mission. They were no longer part of the integrated military structure. But they were, as French are, absolutely charming and delightful, a great source of champagne. Their parties were always the best. So, you know, start of one's international experience, I think.
Well, Sir Michael, thank you. I think we're virtually at the end here. Mm. So we'll leave it here for the moment, if we may.
Mm.
And then another day with you.
Sure. Be delighted to. We've got... we've got that to finish. We've then got the Ministry of Defence. We've then got Squadron Commander. We've then got working as the Assistant to the Chief of Defence Staff, Lucas, the Falklands, SHAPE, Support Command, Strike Command, Whitehall. That's more or less it.
Give a few words about your time.
Well, thank you both very much, and we'll start again soon.
Pleasure.
So, Michael, thank you for this second interview, where we will continue to discuss your career for the Sound Archive of the Imperial War Museum. Thank you very much for that. I think you had one or two points left over from the previous our previous discussion, and perhaps I would ask you to continue from where we left off.
Just a few brief points from a very privileged position as a personal staff officer to the then senior airman in Allied Forces Central Region, with the opportunity to see how things were worked at really very high level with the political and military dimension attached to it. To see, for example, the difference in approach of the Americans, the British, Germans, Dutch, Belgians, so on and so on, to perhaps see how philosophies could be so very, very different between allies. For example, in the northern part of the Allied Forces Central Region, which was predominantly British and German, as opposed to the Central Army Group and 4th Allied Tactical Air Force, which was predominantly American with German, I think we relied on a level of flexibility to do our business and a very, very close cooperation between land and air, whereas in the South it was very, very much more predetermined, massive use of airplanes, much of which was based upon the United States Vietnam experience. Very, very inflexible. No doubt would have been highly effective, but nevertheless, would it have adapted to the changes of war? I don't know. But in the light of things that have happened since, and perhaps even right up to today, 2003, one could already see the discerning characteristics of the nations which play right the way through the political and military field and determine largely the way that they actually operate in war. Very interesting indeed. And I think I came away from that quite well armed with that understanding of perhaps the national psyches. And with a genuine belief in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization as a quite unique and successful organization in holding very disparate peoples together through a common cause. So I went from there to London.
And before we leave Europe and your European posting, you've touched on the political impact there of the internal politics of the nations involved. Given the difficulties that perhaps were experienced over the Bosnian crisis, do you think that really, if the chips ever got down to it, that this quite large organisation, which then had 12 or 15 members, or whatever it is, and is now 15. Double or something, would have worked?
Well, yes, I think it would, quite simply because it was dominated by three nations, and two in particular who worked very, very closely, and no surprises for guessing who that would be, the Americans and the British, and to a degree the Germans, ran the organisation. Now the French, as you will know, were not part of the military structure, they'd withdrawn from that, although they were part of the political structure, so it was a curious arrangement, and we had no doubt at all that the French would fight alongside us, but we weren't able to plan for it, which is pretty bizarre, considering that, you know, once they got through Germany, if the Russians, the Soviets, were to have invaded, they'd have been in France pretty damn quickly as well. But nevertheless, that's the way it was. But the organisation was run by the Americans and the British, and in general terms, the Germans followed up.
Thank you. And then he returned to?
To London, yes. To a job at in the Ministry of Defence, in the Air Force Department, but it was called Operations and Joint Warfare, and probably the most interesting part of it was the joint warfare side of it that brought me into daily contact almost with the Army and the Navy, and particularly the Old Sarum, which was the joint warfare establishment down near Salisbury. It's a fine place where a lot of good work was done, I think, in terms of bringing particularly Army and Air Force together. The Navy and Air Force side was done, as I recall, at a place called Dryad. I think it was Dryad. Anyway, there was a, for obvious reasons, a sort of maritime dimension, but then there was the land air dimension, which was done at El Sarum, and I had some, I had an interesting, I don't know, couple of years there or thereabouts, working a number of projects through, working some ideas through, I can't think what else I did, but I got used to working in the Ministry of Defence, which I can tell you was a shock for a relatively young squadron leader to see the way that the Ministry of Defence, what a ghastly building it was. There were three of us crammed into a room with one kettle, the sort of thing that no self-respecting secretaries would put up with in normal course of events, but it was life.
I've heard another senior officer, very senior officer, describe the Minister of Defence as the madhouse.
Yes. Yes.
Would that be because there was no... it wasn't run, if you like, along efficient military lines. There was something else operating there.
But there had to be realistic. Mad in the sense that it was usually frantic, I would have thought. It always struck me as amazing that one had to work such incredible long hours and so hard, generally speaking. I mean, there were jobs where that was not the case, but the majority of jobs in the planning and in the operations side were pretty frantic. At a time when we actually went at war. You know, why was it so? And the answer, I suppose, was because, as usual, we were trying to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. You know, there was a level of commitment of the nation to the NATO alliance, which was our major concern, plus our residual worldwide obligations, with a level of resources which was never enough. At least that was the way that we saw it. And every year there would be some crisis of overspend in something, and there'd be a frantic rush around trying to find the money, and things would be cancelled. And it was mad, because the budgets in those days, if you didn't spend all the money by the 31st of March, you lost it. So and you never knew how much money you got to spend, because the accounting system was so archaic, that until about, you know, February time, you'd suddenly realise that, my God, we've underspent by, you know, £1 billion, and they'd be frantic rushing around trying to spend all this money, most of which was quite... You didn't finish up spending it. You lost it. But what a daft way to run a railroad. Equally, you'd find you've got a most ghastly overspend, you know, with only about 2 months to go, and there'd be a frantic rushing around there. How are we going to deal with this one? And this would be cut, and bloody silly things would be done. It was a nonsensical accounting procedure which led to some really daft ways of doing business, overlaid with political considerations, some of which were, to say the least, not in the